Okay, welcome to Mythology Part 5, our fifth and last one, unfortunately. And we could go on and on. So today we're going to talk about the Trojan War, which is especially the two great epic poems, Homer's Iliad and Odyssey. Whether they're by the same person or who that person was there a Homer? We're not going to get into that. But people say, what can I read about mythology? The best thing you can do is go read the Iliad and the Odyssey. There's no better summer reading to read on the beach. That's why the Odyssey is one of the greatest stories ever, because it's enjoyable for everybody, right? People say, well, I can't read that as if, you know, I'm asking you to read the encyclopedia in German or something. This is the best literature ever, so that's for everybody, okay? So let's first set the stage with some of the characters, where they come from. Well, Atreus was a powerful king in the area of Mycenae, which is actually where the dynasty of Heracles and Perseus came from. Perseus supposedly built the palace of Mycenae, and you know that all this supposedly takes place in the Bronze Age. Now we know there are big palaces there in the 13th century BC. So this is close to 1200 BC when the Trojan War would have been, if there was a Trojan War. It'd be the end of the Bronze Age. Okay, so in that area there's now a new dynasty, the House of Atreus. Atreus had two sons, Agamemnon and Menelaus, who were called the Atreids, meaning the sons of Atreus. And they married two sisters. Agamemnon became king of Mycenae and married Clytemnestra. And his brother Menelaus went down to Sparta, a little bit to the south, and married the princess Helen, who was the daughter of the queen of the king of Sparta, and he became king of Sparta. Okay, let's say where Helen came from. The so-called Helen of Greece, but remember she's Helen of Greece before she's Helen of Troy. Okay, well, now Zeus is up to it again. Zeus falls in love with a woman named Leda, and he comes to Leda in the form of a swan. Leda and the swan. Yep, there he is. And a popular subject in art. That's in the Getty Museum in LA. Leonardo da Vinci liked this theme. There's no secret code in that one, by the way. So Leda got pregnant, and she also had a mortal husband, Tyndareus. So Leda laid two eggs as a result of this. From one egg, those were the sons and daughter of Zeus, two children of Zeus and Leda, who are Helen and Polydeuces, who's better known as Pollux, the Latin form of his name. And then there were two other brothers and sisters, Castor and Clytemnestra. So two girls, Helen and Clytemnestra, and two boys, Castor and Pollux, they're better known as, because they became bigger for the Romans. So Helen is a demigod. Everyone wanted to marry Helen. She was the most beautiful woman. She had suitors from all around. And this is a common type of story, a suitor story. The suitors of a woman get together and compete to win the woman. So all the heroes came from all over. Ajax, Odysseus, Diomedes, Patroclus, Menelaus. And they swore an oath to her father that they would all swear to protect the marriage whoever married her. This became one of the mythical reasons why they all had to go in the Trojan War to get her back later on. So Menelaus won, and Menelaus married Helen. And he married the princess and succeeded to her father's throne. I think we talked about that last time. It's a way of saying the descent for the king of Sparta is through the daughter. But it's who the daughter marries, the son-in-law inherits. That way it's partly inheritance and also merit. He has to prove to be the best and earn it. So you don't get just blind inheritance where it can decline over time. And her sister Clytemnestra married Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae. The name Clytemnestra actually means she is famous for being wooed, for having many suitors. So there's that type of story again, although there's no story in that case that we have. Okay, now we need to put another character in place and go up north to set the stage where another character came from, Achilles. And really the whole war began from the wedding of Achilles' parents. He came up and he came from a more northerly region of Greece, Thessaly. And his mother, Thetis, was a sea nymph, actually a goddess, called a Nereid, a sea nymph who's the daughter of Nereus, the old man of the sea. Well, Zeus wanted Thetis, but in this case he restrained himself. He was warned off by a prophecy that Thetis would have a son who would be greater than his father. And Zeus couldn't have that because then somebody would overthrow Zeus, the way he overthrew Cronus and Cronus overthrew Uranus back in the creation story. And actually Prometheus was the one who knew that secret. So he revealed that secret to Zeus, and in return, that's why Zeus allowed Hercules to free Prometheus. So instead of Zeus going for Thetis, uncharacteristically, he marries her off to someone else, a mortal, Peleus. And the wedding of Peleus and Thetis was the grandest wedding ever. All the gods and goddesses were present, except one, Eris. You do not want to invite Eris to your wedding. Eris, with an I, E-R-I-S, means discord, strife. And the marriage is supposed to be Eros, E-R-O-S, love, union. So Eris was not invited and crashed the wedding. And made trouble. That's her job. She threw a golden apple in with one word on it. For the fairest goddess. In Greek, that's just one word. And this is the famous apple of discord, since Discordia is the Latin name. Well, three goddesses contended for this. Hera, Aphrodite, and Athena quarrel. Which is the most beautiful one who deserves the golden apple? Golden means it's immortal, divine. So they decide to bring the matter to a prince of Troy named Paris. So they go over to Asia, actually. Troy is in the northwestern peninsula of Turkey, and they were not Greek. So this is called the Judgment of Paris. They bring it to Paris to decide. Paris is the son of the king of Troy. The old king of Troy was King Priam, and his son Paris is kind of a lover boy, and his other son Hector is the great warrior, the great defender of Troy. So this is how the Trojans get mixed up in the story. Paris had two names, Paris or Alexander. Okay, the three goddesses come to this prince of Troy, who again is in Asia, and non-Greek, the judgment of Paris. And they bribe him. Well, they try to bribe him. Hera says, I'm the queen of heaven. I will offer you rule of the world if you choose me. And there's Hera. You can see Athena is the next one here with the helmet. Athena said, I am a warrior. I will give you military triumphs and glory. Okay, that sounds pretty good. But Aphrodite comes along. I am the goddess of love. I will give you the most beautiful woman in the world. And Paris was not a typical warrior or a hero. He chose love, make love, not war. And this is partly a story about the power of love. These are a couple of Renaissance paintings by Rubens of the Judgment of Paris. And, by the way, they liked pagan themes because they could show naked people and be a little freer, which again happened again in the 19th and 20th centuries. And this is from the web, the Judgment of Paris made out of Barbie dolls. That I call bad judgment. And the funny thing is, that's a copy of the Rubens painting. So it's a couple of levels removed from myth like you always have. That just shows how rich the myths are that can be used anyway. Or as Karl Marx said, history repeats itself. The first time it's tragic, and the second time when it repeats itself, it's comic. So Aphrodite granted Paris Helen. He awarded her the Apple Prize, and he went over to get Helen. But there was one little problem. Helen was married to Menelaus. So he went to visit his friend Menelaus and ran off with his wife. That is not good Greek hospitality. And people always wonder, did he rape her or did Helen go willingly? And the story says that Helen fell in love with him too. She went willingly. You could say that was part of Aphrodite's scheme to engineer that in her as well. But nowadays, if you see movies about this, they actually glorify the love of Paris and Helen as if that's true love and she's following her heart, that she gets to choose and be more free. Whereas in these recent movies, they've taken this feminist line that her marriage to Menelaus was a fraud because women are oppressed in marriage, and this kind of thing is the recent reworking of the story. But it never says that Menelaus was bad. These kind of later movies play that up. But the Greeks did think this was a story about the power of Eros. And Sappho actually wrote some nice poems about this, who's a poet later, about 600 BC, from Lesbos, the original lesbian, literally and also figuratively as well. And she said, look at the power of Eros. Helen left her husband and children and her family and home out of the power of love, that love can break all bonds. Love cannot be controlled by institutions like marriage or rules, that it's a strong force in the universe, like we saw with the Greek Eurasian stories. Eros was the fourth thing that came into the universe. It was a force in the universe that brought things together. But the flip side of that is Eros. You have both these two forces in the universe. Love brings things together, Eros brings things apart. So go back to the wedding of Achilles' parents. At the wedding, this is a celebration of Eros, union, and their union gives birth to the child Achilles. But also at the wedding, you have strife come in, Eros, which eventually causes Achilles' death in the Trojan War. So love and strife are together, and that is a Greek view of the world, that there's always good and bad, tragic, is unavoidable. So that's why Helen is called the face that launched 1,000 ships, a line that comes from a poem by Christopher Marlowe in the 16th century. So when people say Helen of Troy, remember she was Helen of Greece first. Okay, so let's say, so what happened to Achilles first? Let's say more about him to put the characters in place again. Achilles is born from his parents Peleus and Thetis. Thetis is a sea nymph that makes Achilles a demigod, typical of a hero, half divine, half mortal in his parentage. So what is he? Which way is he going to go? And Achilles would have been the next one to overthrow Zeus if Zeus hadn't married her off to someone else. That partly explains his importance as a great hero. Well, when he was a baby, his mother Thetis tried to make him immortal. Everybody hears the story how she held him by the heel and dipped him in the river Styx, the river of the gods that separates our world from the next world, the river of death. But, you know, only his heel did not get coated, so he had the fatal flaw, the Achilles heel. What is his Achilles heel? It's that he is mortal. He could be coated with immortality, but she could not make him immortal completely. That's impossible for the Greeks. You can't have a baby who becomes a savior like a divine child like Jesus. Remember the Demeter myth? She was trying to make a boy immortal, and it was prevented in that story. And actually, in the original of the Achilles story, his mother was burning him in a fire to make him immortal, just like Demeter was doing to a boy in the story of Demeter and Persephone. And the story of dipping him in the river Styx is only found in a Roman poet in the 1st century A.D. for the first time. So for me, that's late. That's very late and decadent source. But that's a message about mortality, that the hero is still mortal. Right? So nowadays we talk about it and we say, oh, my Achilles heel. My Achilles heel is chocolate. I've got this weakness for chocolate. We talk as if everything is psychology. And when people talk about the myths, they want to talk about all psychology, or sociology. Oh, what does it say about women and stuff like that, gender? But for the Greeks, it was existential. This is about existence. His Achilles' heel is that he is mortal. You cannot escape your mortality if you were born to a mortal parent. And that's a lesson he learns, just as Gilgamesh learned that before. And this is why the myths are great messages of humanities, and not just what some guy did in 1200 whatever BC, but why they're about us and living in the world. Okay? So Achilles was raised by a centaur, Chiron, who was the friendly centaur who raised Achilles in the woods. Centaurs were located in northern Greece until a while ago. Now they're extinct. And he gave him an ash spear from an ash tree. Achilles had the famous ash spear. Here's Chiron and Achilles in a Roman wall painting, 1st century AD. Can you see? Okay. So Achilles is the main warrior in Greece, and he's actually from this area up north. And Agamemnon and Menelaus are the leaders of the expedition. Okay, so now Paris has taken Helen to Troy, and Menelaus is the king of Sparta, and his brother Agamemnon, the king of Mycenae, they're married to the two sisters. They become the leaders of the Greek expedition, the Trojan War. And so they get their friends who are kings from all over Greece. You know, there was no one Greece. At this time, there are palaces everywhere with local kings. But they had various alliances. They would intermarry. They would visit each other and exchange gifts. And they call all these allies together. And actually, there were more than 1,000 ships. If you add them together, because Homer's Iliad lists the number of ships and who were the leaders from each area, how many ships and men they brought, there are 1,186 ships. Okay. So the Greeks gather from all over, that's such as Odysseus from the island of Ithaca, which is this little one here. Or the great Ajax from over here. Diomedes from, from Tiryns down the road from Mycenae. And so on, every area of Greece, including Crete, and some of the islands. So those are all these arrows. The Greek ships gather here in Aulis at this port. And they said this was kind of a world war. The little red guys on this map were the Trojans. Notice that the Trojans had allies all around, too, around Asia. And the Greeks, actually, later on, the Greeks saw this as the beginning of the conflict between West and East. The Greeks were West, the Trojans were East. Because here's Europe, and here's Asia. And the Greeks are the ones who defined that boundary, that we still use that boundary. And by the way, the country of Greece is always kind of ambiguous. Is it, how Western is it? It's right on the edge. It's right on the border here. And by the way, the word Asia originally meant a little meadow over here on the coast of Turkey in Greek. That's what it means in the Iliad. Okay, so they thought this was the biggest expedition ever. The Greeks gather at Aulis. But there's a little problem. They have bad winds. The fleet cannot set sail for Troy. Agamemnon has angered Artemis. He has to sacrifice his daughter to appease the goddess. That's the best type of sacrifice, royal blood. So Agamemnon has to send home to Mycenae and he says, send Iphigenia because I want her to marry Achilles. Achilles, by the way, was a young man in this. He was probably a teenager. And it's a trick. Agamemnon shows up and she is married not to Achilles but to death. This is the way the Greek tragedies talk. She becomes a bride of death because Agamemnon has to sacrifice his own daughter, Iphigenia, at the altar. Maybe you know an opera, right? Iphigenia at Aulis, or Tragedy by Euripides. This is also a Roman wall painting of Iphigenia going out dressed as a bride, but tragically. Okay, so one theme here is that there's a theme about heroes here. Agamemnon is the leader. He's the leader of the expedition because he leads the most men, and Mycenae is the greatest kingdom. And sometimes Agamemnon and his brother, both of the Atreids, or the two sons of Atreus, are called the two leaders as well. But Agamemnon is the leader. He's the king. They're all kings, actually. And he has to do his job. He has to lead the mission. So he has a very public role, this very manly role. And this is called a shame culture, this type of thing, where he cannot lose shame among the other leaders. He has to keep his position as leader. And to do this, he has to sacrifice his private life and his household. So he has to sacrifice his family to his job, or he puts the public over the private. And that's the dilemma of a hero. They're caught in what's called the heroic culture or the shame culture. And the term for this is shame culture, which comes from actually study of warrior Japan by Ruth Benedict, this anthropologist who went there in the 40s after the war and popularized this notion for a warrior culture. But you see how it's tragic for hero, and that becomes the theme of the Iliad as well. So the ships are able to set sail and get a favorable wind. When they come to Troy, they first land on a little island off the coast, where Philoctetes is bitten by a snake. And they have to leave this hero, Philoctetes, on the island. He has with him the bow of Heracles, because Heracles gave it to him on his deathbed. Although Hercules didn't actually die, remember, he was brought up to Olympus in an apotheosis. He became a god at the end. Zeus brought him up. But on his deathbed, when he thought he was dying, he gave his bow to Philoctetes, and now he's stranded on this island with it. And there's a Greek tragedy called Philoctetes. And then when they landed at the coast of Troy, the first Greek to land was killed, Protesilaus. Now, all this is not in Homer's Iliad. Homer's Iliad is the greatest work about the Trojan War, and of course one of the greatest works ever, and the first work of European literature, if it was European at the time. And it's from the 8th century B.C. But that's just when we think it was written down first, because that's when the Greeks got the alphabet. And it tells the legends of hundreds of years earlier, from 1200-something B.C., from these heroes who were kings in Bronze Age palaces, when the Trojan War would have taken place. But the thing is, from the Trojan War down to Homer's time, the Greeks were illiterate. And they passed down these stories through oral tradition, oral bards, singing long poems from memory and also improvising as they went. And these type of bards existed around the world into the 20th century. So Homer, in other words, Homer's the main source. We call him the first European literature, but he's actually the last of this long line of oral bards that was able to be written down when the Greeks got the alphabet about 750 B.C. Okay, we're saying this because that's the major read about the Trojan War, but the Iliad doesn't go through A, B, C, D, like we're doing here. The Iliad begins, do you remember where it begins? It doesn't begin in the first year of the war. Oh, very good. You had some Latin or Greek. It begins in the middle of things, you said, right? In medias res. And where, what year of the war, do you know? And right there, right? It starts in the 9th year of the war, since the Greeks were besieging Troy for 10 years and only took it in the 10th year. Sorry to tell you what happened already, but the great thing is not what happened, but what Homer does with it. So I was going to say, okay, we're going to be Greeks. We'll be the Greeks here. And we're going to win the Trojan War. But it's not that simple. For one, there were no Greeks yet. They were not called Greeks yet. They're called Achaeans, or Danaans, or Argives. The word Greek was just a local name, and it didn't become applied to all the Greeks until later. In fact, it's what the Romans called them. We probably get that from the Roman Latin name, Graeci. But that just shows how prehistoric it is. It's a whole early society. Homer is an entire world. There's a famous line, by the way. Homer is a world. Virgil is a style. Since Virgil later came and wrote a Latin poem about all this epic themes. Okay, so we'll be Achaeans. But it's not that simple. Because the Achaeans won the war, but what Homer says is the Achaeans and Trojans are no different. They both lose. It's a tragedy of both sides, right? So we have to be both, and that's what makes the poem great, a great poem about humanity. It's not a triumphalist work, in other words. Like, if we tell a story of a war, you can tell how it's going to go. These are pretty simple stories, right? Remember the Gulf War in 91, right? It was like a cartoon. We won. We rolled over them. It was people told it like it was a football game that was a 100-0 rout, right? It's all triumphalist, patriotic. And you might expect that from the Iliad, a story of how great these Greek heroes are, and they smashed Troy. But it's not like that. It shows a tragedy of Troy. Because we'll see this in a second, but here's something else general about that. The Greeks are an army, so all their ships are camped on the beach at Troy. And they're living in these tents for 10 years. The Greeks are an army camp. They're just warriors, the Achaeans. The Trojans, you see them with their homes and families and wives and children sometime. Homer depicts this. So that's the society which is going to be destroyed by the war. The Greeks are abnormal. They're just a bunch of men out for glory. And Agamemnon has already sacrificed his family, you have seen, to get this. So he portrays the Trojans sympathetically as very human. And it's a tragedy of Troy. And it's a tragedy of the Greeks as well, because if you win in war, you know, do you win? Does anybody... You both lose, he says. Now, this is very relevant all the time. So we don't have to say how it's in the newspapers now, because it's all the time. It's at least for this Greek view of life that is full of suffering. Okay, so Homer is great also because he starts in the 9th year of the war. But in the work, he manages to give flashbacks. Like at one point, he describes the catalog of ships. He says, tell me, Muse, who are the men in the ships that came to Troy? And he lists all the leaders and how many ships and men they brought. This is something you would not do in the 9th year of the war, but it's a flashback to fill you in on the beginning of the war. And he has various things like that. So the thing is that the Iliad is so great because it is a microcosm. It only covers 42 days in the 9th year of the war, but it has flashbacks to the beginning of the war, Helen and so forth, and it also has foreshadowings. You know what's going to happen to Troy at the end. It gets it all in this great literary work that doesn't just go ABC, then this happened and this happened, like a mythology handbook. And Aristotle says that's the way you should write. Aristotle says Homer's poems survive and all these other poems are lost because he wrote that way with one theme and its workings out. And I tell students to write papers that way. And maybe they do sometimes. Okay. So... why is it called the Iliad? What is the word Iliad? Troy. Ilios. Although, funny enough, Greek used to have a W that was lost, and it would have been Willias originally. So we would have had the Williad. That sounds kind of comical. That might be a funny poem about Bill Clinton, the Williad. Okay. So one of the flashbacks you find in the Iliad is that it describes the Greek heroes. At one point, the Trojan elders are sitting at the walls of Troy looking down on the fighting. This old king Priam and some other elders. And Priam, by the way, says, oh, I wish I was young and I could fight like it did in the old days when the Amazons came. And they were women who fought like men. And I fought with them. So that's what we said last time. There were various stories about the Amazons located in Asia. So there it comes up there again. And these elders are sitting there, and Helen comes up to the wall. And Priam says, Helen, who are these Greeks? Tell me who they are, since these are your relatives and former friends. It's very sad. And by the way, this is a flashback, because you would never have this in the 9th year of the war. It's a sort of literary device to fill you in. So here you get a characterization of some of these heroes in a scene called Helen at the Wall. And she says, she expresses regret. She says, well, I wish it was not thus, and I wither in self-reproach. So let me answer what you ask. That man is the son of Atreus, Agamemnon, ruler of empire, combining the wisdom of kings with a soldier's courage and skill, brother-in-law to a slut, but so distant it seems like a dream. That was her own words, that's an exact quote, that she feels regret for this war. And then they see Odysseus, and Priam says, you know, who is that? He looks shorter than Agamemnon, but broader and deeper of chest. Helen answered, a different sort of man, for that is the crafty Odysseus, son of Laertes, brought up in Ithaca's rocky village. Rocky Ithaca's village, skilled in all sorts of devices and clever, deceitful maneuvers. Here's the tricky one. He didn't look like a hero. They said he wasn't a lot to look at, but once he started talking, words flowed from him, the great mind, the great powers of persuasion. And there's Ithaca, a tiny island up in the northwest of Greece. And Helen says, and that one is Ajax the Mighty, a wall of defense to the Greeks. Ajax was the second greatest warrior after Achilles. And there's something very poignant here. And then Priam says, Helen says, but where are my two brothers, Castor and Polydeuces, from Sparta? Didn't they come with the army? And the poet answers, so Helen wondered, but in fact, the life-giving earth of Sparta, their own dear country, enshrouded the two. She didn't know they were dead. But the beautiful thing there is the wording. The life-giving earth covered them, right? And people used to say, this doesn't make sense. If they're dead, why does he call it the life-giving earth? And they used to say a whole verse just full of formulas because they would have to memorize these words because it was oral poetry. But that's great poetry. Homer took care of every word just as a great poet or a good writer does. So, right? And that's a Greek theme. They're dead, but the earth is still life-giving, you know, pushing up daisies. But the cycle goes on, right? So that's some of the beauty of Homer, how he comments on everything in terms of existence, life, and death. Okay, so here's a little story of the Iliad. We'll say it for a while and then take a break and say the Odyssey story, okay? But we can't do the whole Iliad. I wish we could. So it begins in the ninth year with a fight between Achilles and Agamemnon. Agamemnon is the king and the leader of this combined force, which includes many kings from all over. And Achilles is the greatest warrior. So they have a fight, which is a classic fight between status and merit. Agamemnon inherited his position. He has status. Achilles says, I'm greater. I've got the real merit. I do all the work. How come you always get the rewards? Somebody wrote a book saying that's a typical theme in medieval epics as well. The king versus the warrior. So this starts over a woman. They have a fight over a woman. They had captured a town down the coast and taken prize women and divided them up. Agamemnon got first choice. Well, Agamemnon's woman happened to be the daughter of the priest of Apollo. So the priest of Apollo prays to Apollo and comes to the Achaean camp to beg for his daughter back. And Agamemnon insults him. And you're not supposed to insult the priest of Apollo. Because what does he do? The priest prays to Apollo to send a plague to the Greeks. And how does Apollo send the plague? What's Apollo's weapon? Remember? He shoots arrows. He's the far shooter. And he can heal you, but he can also send disease with his arrows. So Apollo sends this plague, and the Greeks are dying in the camp of the Achaeans. And Achilles, then he takes charge and says, it's all Agamemnon's fault. He insulted the priest. And he calls another prophet in to say what's wrong. And by the way, prophets in ancient times had to prophesy about the past as well as the future. They had to prophesy the past to say what was wrong and what caused the plague or something like that, right? So now Achilles is insulting Agamemnon. Agamemnon is insulted that Achilles is telling him off, and they have a fight full of colorful language. And Achilles calls Agamemnon all these insults. You have the heart of a deer. You're a coward. And Agamemnon says, okay, just for that, if I have to give back my prize woman, I'll take yours, Achilles, just because you think you're so great. I'm the king. I can do what I want to. So he goes and takes Achilles' prize, Briseis. And this leads to the anger of Achilles. Actually, the first word of the poem is the anger of Achilles. Seeing goddess of the anger of Achilles. The first word in European literature is anger. But it's actually this divine anger that only gods have plus Achilles, because he's a demigod. It's something very special and powerful. And that's what sets the action of the Iliad in motion. So by the way, it starts over a woman, just the way the Trojan War had started over Helen. So Agamemnon's men come and take Briseis from Achilles' camp, and Achilles says, I'm not going to fight for you. Achilles leaves the army, and he withdraws from the public the heroic code, the team, he withdraws into his own tent, and here's a famous vase of him playing a board game with Ajax. And he says, I'm not going to fight for you. Why should I fight for Agamemnon and Menelaus for them to get glory? He says, the Trojans didn't steal my woman, I'm not even married, or my cattle, and they get all the glory, and he withdraws, and he raises all kinds of questions about the individual versus society, which come out in a minute. That's the beach where the Achaean ships may have been beached, at Troy. Right? And you can... Somebody been to Troy? Oh, you can visit there. Okay. Yes? Okay. So, then at one point... Okay, so Achilles is out of the action, and his mother Thetis goes up to Zeus. And first she comes to Achilles, and she says, oh, Achilles, I will give you honor. I'll go to Zeus. He owes me a favor. Because once I protected him when the other gods were trying to gang up on Zeus. And Thetis goes to Zeus and says, Zeus, give my son Achilles honor. He is the best of the Achaeans, but he has been dishonored. They took his prize and he lost face. So how did Zeus give him honor? Zeus says, okay, I will let the Trojans win. I will let the Trojans push the Achaeans back to the ships. The Achaeans will lose and they will know how much they miss Achilles, the best of the Achaeans. So Achilles has to actually turn against his own society. Some people think he's childish, that every time he gets in trouble, he cries to his mother. but he had a real point of principle against Agamemnon, who was behaving like a bad king. Although Agamemnon wasn't all bad, by the way, either. In the stories of the battle, like the description of Helen at the wall, he's described as very heroic and courageous as well, although a lot of people don't think that because they read this kind of this fight at the beginning of the work. Okay, so then they have to fight without Achilles, the greatest warrior. And at one point they say, well, let's have a single combat. This is all about Helen. So why don't Menelaus and Paris just fight it out about Helen? Whoever wins can get Helen. We'll all go home. Stop this. So they have a single combat, Menelaus against Paris. And by the way, this is something you might do at the beginning of the war. This is something else Homer puts in as a flashback to refer to the cause of the war. It wouldn't have really happened in the ninth year. It wouldn't make sense. It's one of these flashbacks in the Iliad. So they have a combat, and Menelaus is winning. But Aphrodite comes down and protects Paris and swoops him off the battlefield and takes him back to Helen. And Helen doesn't even want to go to bed with him. She says, you coward, you don't even fight. So his brother Hector doesn't like this. Hector has to come at one point and come back and get Paris and say, come on, stop making love, stop being a lover boy. This whole war is because of you. Why can't you even be brave and fight with the rest of us? And he has to pull him out back out to the battle. Okay, and here's a great scene in the story where we see the Trojan side. That's what makes the story great about humanity. Hector is the great warrior of Troy. He's the brother of Paris, and their father Priam is too, the king is too old. So the whole hope of Troy rests on Hector. And this is much better than the Troy movie, by the way. Right? And the funny thing about the Troy movie is they left the gods out. How can you have the Iliad without the gods, right? Okay, because the Greek gods were real. They're real as any other gods, right? Right?
Right.
And, okay, so at one point Hector goes... is back in town, and he's leaving out the gate to fight. And his wife Andromache meets him with their baby son Astyanax, which means the lord of the city. So that's a male heroic term for this public role that the heroes have. But here you have a little debate, because Andromache and Astyanax represent the family. And Andromache says, Hector, don't go out and fight. You're my whole family. Achilles has killed my father and mother, my brothers. You, Hector, are my father and mother and brothers. You're all I have left. Stay here, pity our dear son, lest he be orphaned, and I be a widow and be taken to Greece as a slave. Don't you pity this child at all, or your poor wife, doomed to be called your widow. Once we lose you, everyone in Troy will suffer. They'll slave the women. So she's appealing to him to leave the public, leave the heroic code, and stay home in the private life. But he can't do this. He's a hero. And he says, shame on me if I don't fight in the front ranks. I will not be a leader anymore. I will not get double portions at the banquets, you know, and all this, and all the perks that came with it. You have to keep your position. He said, I'll be shamed before the men of Troy. That's called the heroic code or the shame culture. What other people think of you. And that's how much he's caught up in it. And he says, well, yes, you'll be a widow and a slave wife to some Greek man. But people will see you and say, wow, there goes the wife of Hector. So it's still about his glory. Heroes want fame, glory. Klaos in Greek is glory. That's in the name Heracles, by the way. Remember my glory of Hera. K-L-E-O-S. They want glory. So he's so bound up in that, and then he has to go fight, and he grabs goes to take the baby to say goodbye, but the baby withdraws from his helmet. So what does that say, right? It scares the child. So there you get the public against private again. And this is what archaeologists found, a gate off to the side of Troy, that is maybe the one Homer talks about, the Scaean Gate, the ramp for your chariots. Okay, so the Trojans are now beating the Greeks. The Trojans are having a lot of success, and they come up to the Greek ships and almost set fire to the ships. So it's a real disaster. This is a doctor. The Greeks had a couple of sons of Asclepius, the god of medicine. These are good people to have in your army. So they had these healers, and here's a picture of healing a wounded soldier. So the Greeks are losing, and they have to go beg Achilles to come back. And this is called the Embassy to Achilles. It's book 9 of the Iliad, which is divided into 24 books, which are more like chapters for us. So Agamemnon has to try to bribe him to come back. He says, I'll let him marry my daughter. I'll give him cities to rule, and they'll give him all kinds of gifts. And he bribes him with material rewards, but Achilles doesn't want this. He's not in it for that. His pride is wounded, and it's a matter of principle. So this is when Achilles makes a famous speech. Achilles says, why should we fight at all? He questions his whole heroic code. This is what makes Achilles great and the work great. And the movie couldn't capture this fully. It tried to do this a little bit of Achilles' emotions, actually. But Achilles becomes reflective, and he says, why should we fight here at Troy? The same fate awaits a man whether he's a coward or brave. You'll be killed in war. Anybody can be killed any time. And is that just about war? No, that's about life. That's why it's a great poem. Anything can happen to you. So he says, why don't I just go home? Why should I fight for their women and their cattle? That's what they fought wars over back then. And he says, why don't I go back home, and my father Peleus will find a woman for me and give me a lot of land, and I can rule these towns up in northern Greece. In other words, go to the private life. And he says, I can have a long life without all this grief. Because my mother Thetis told me I have two paths in life, one or the other way of life. I can stay here, attacking the city and land of the Trojans, and all hope of returning home is lost, but I win undying glory. Okay, so you die young, but your name lives on. That's called indirect immortality. You don't live on, but your name lives on. That's what Gilgamesh and some other heroes say they want, because they know they're mortal, but they want to get as much as they can. Fame is a type of immortality. And that's one choice for Achilles. The other is, I can choose to return to the land of my fathers. I bid farewell to glory, but I survive to a quiet old age. Death will be slow to find me, the end of all men. Well, this is called Achilles' dilemma. Which way of life do you choose? That's why it's about life. You know, what do you do if you... We all have this choice, right? You ever think about, you know, what if you had 10 years to live or 2 years to live? What would you do with it, right? Well, that's what we always have, no matter how old we are. So It's an existential work, and Achilles really doesn't have any choice, though. He debates going home, but really, he's a hero. He cannot get out of this, and you know all along he'll be drawn back in. It's pretty inevitable. So the way he's drawn back in, that's what we were talking about there on that slide. He has a best friend, Patroclus. In the movie, Troy, they made him the cousin. And he's not really Achilles' cousin. That was just a way of trying to show they're very close. Because some people suggest, oh, these two are so close, they must have been homosexual lovers. And this is not the case in Homer. There's no hint of it. And that was not rampant in Greece in Homer's time. That became bigger later. So later in Athens, when they were all running around doing that, they said, oh, look at Achilles and Patroclus. They were the first famous example or something. But they really weren't. They were just close male friends. Sometimes I think we have a problem with that in our society, so people think, oh, they must have been, you know. So Patroclus is his best friend. And Patroclus feels sorry for all the Greeks who are suffering. So he comes to Achilles and says, if you won't go back, you are so hard-hearted, you're like a rock, you're stubborn, pitiless. You know, Achilles sometimes looks bad and unyielding. And he says, if you won't go back, let me go back and fight. Let me wear your armor, Achilles. They'll think it's you. And I'll rally the troops and scare the Trojans. So Patroclus goes back in the armor of Achilles. And for a while, it looks like Achilles. Imagine like a baseball game where he comes running out in Achilles' uniform. Oh, it's Achilles, right? And he's got a mask on, a helmet, like football maybe. And he's mowing down the Trojans. But then Hector confronts him, and you have single combat between Hector and Patroclus. They know it's Patroclus. And Hector, the Trojan warrior, kills Patroclus. Now, for the audience, you see Patroclus falling down and in Achilles' armor. It's like he has a big Achilles name on his back. Right? So this is foreshadowing of the death of Achilles. And Hector is bragging over him. And Patroclus says, Hector, do not brag, because you are next. What goes around kills, comes around. You're right. If you kill me, well, a better man than I, Achilles, will kill you, because no one can escape this. So, a little existential message. They talk a lot, these heroes, before they kill each other. And as is actually a famous one, I have to say, at one point, let's just pause at this dramatic scene for a second, and to draw it out the way Homer does at a crucial moment. Because there's another scene where two warriors meet each other, a Greek and a Trojan. And they say, hey, we're old friends. Our grandfathers knew each other. Wow. And they give long speeches. And they say, and then one of them says, well, tell me about your family. And he answers, why ask about the generations of men? As are the generations of leaves, so are the generations of men. They come and they fall off and they come back. And that's one of my favorite lines. Okay. So the poem is about death, but it's about life and existence. And not just war, but life. Okay, so Patroclus is dead. And this is actually Ray's painting of another famous warrior who dies in the Iliad. Zeus had a son, Sarpedon, who was on the Trojan side. And Sarpedon was killed, and Zeus says, should I save him from death? Should I raise him up? And Hera said, Zeus, even you cannot change fate. Don't do that, or then all the gods will start raising up their favorites. And that's, again, about existence, the gap between mortals and immortals. That even the son of Zeus, Sarpedon, who's a demigod, dies. So Homer has what's called the mortal hero. And that's what Achilles knew, that when he comes back, he'll die. He's mortal, even though he's a demigod. This is a famous vase in the Metropolitan Museum, The Death of Sarpedon. Have you seen this? It was in the news recently.
Yeah. They're giving that back, right?
Yeah, that's right. They have to give it back because it was found to be robbed from a tomb in Etruria. And they bought it for $1 million in the early 70s. It was one of the most expensive purchases at the time, and these are the gods sleep and death carrying the body of Sarpedon, the noble death. Notice the gods look the same as the mortal. Okay, now, this is why Achilles comes back. He comes back now for a private reason. to avenge the death of Patroclus. So in other words, he is still angry. He's still not made up with his society and gone back with the Achaeans. He hasn't made up with Agamemnon or really, really bought into the heroic code again. He's not back in society. He goes back as an individual for private reasons. He needs a new suit of armor. So his mother Thetis goes to Hephaestus, who is the worker god, the smith, and the god of the forge and fire. And Hephaestus makes a new suit of armor for Achilles. And there's a great description here in the poem that he makes a shield of Achilles, which is round, and he depicts scenes all around the shield. The shield is a microcosm. It depicts the universe. And on it, he depicts two cities of men. One is a city at peace, and they're celebrating a wedding and feasting. The other is a city at war, and they are fighting. It's a beautiful, all of life is on this shield. Homer describes at great length all the scenes of the world on the shield. And this kind of thing shows you that Homer is not just a war poem. He's not glorifying war. He's showing you how much is lost in war. That, you know, Hector's wife and child are going to suffer. The Trojans are going to lose their families. And the city at peace is much better than the city at war. So the poet adds these things throughout the work to remind you, to regret the fact that they're always fighting. Remember, by the way, the god Ares was not so big for the Greeks. Did we say Ares when we talked about the Greek gods? The Greeks are always fighting each other. They thought life was struggle. Greek cities were always fighting each other. In this poem, they're always fighting. That's the human condition. It's hard. You have to work and struggle and suffer. But they did not glorify Ares. They regretted the fact that this was the case. So the Iliad puts in scenes of peace and regrets for that. And at one point in the Iliad, Zeus says to Ares, who is the same as Mars, the god of war, Zeus says, Ares, all the other gods hate you because war and fighting and bloodshed are always dear to your heart. So even in the Iliad they say that. Okay, now back to Achilles. Okay, what happens here in the story? So it's more than just a story we're saying. Achilles comes back with his new armor and he goes berserk. Remember the word berserk is from, I think, the Prussian army. It's a term for going mad in war. And he's mowing down the Trojans. He is pitiless. He even fights with a river god. There were two rivers at Troy, which is one way archaeologists found Troy, and one was the river god Scamander. Well, this was filled up with so many corpses and blood from Achilles killing all these Trojans that the river god got angry and reared up to fight Achilles. You're choking me with corpses. And he fights the river. So he's going crazy. And somebody begs for his death. Achilles slays him mercilessly. So it comes down to Achilles against Hector. Single combat. He's out for revenge, remember, to get Hector for killing Patroclus. And a beautiful scene. They raced around the walls of Troy. Three times Achilles chased Hector. If you ever go to Troy, you have to run around the walls. But you want to be Achilles. And Homer says, they raced not for a tripod, not for a woman, but for the life of a man. The life of manslaying Hector. And Hector had a friend with him. That was Apollo in disguise. But Apollo left him. And he's there alone, his friend disappears. And when Apollo leaves you, you know. So they throw spears back and forth. Achilles killed Hector. Now, by the way, you know all Troy is going to fall. The poem doesn't go that far. It foreshadows all this. Achilles killed Hector. And he mutilated the body. He maltreated the body. What did he do? Can you see this? Yeah, he tied him to his chariot and dragged him around. This is a Roman sarcophagus from the Roman Empire. And you're not supposed to do this because there are certain rules in war, but more importantly, dead bodies belong to the gods. There are certain rules about how to treat a dead body. It's not your business anymore. This is the theme of the Antigone tragedy, if you remember that. So he defiles the corpse. He brings Hector's body to his tent. And here it is lying under his couch. So first he put on funeral games for Patroclus, actually. He put on a large funeral for Patroclus, at which he sacrificed 10 Trojans, human sacrifice of 10 Trojan prisoners. And he put on all these funeral games, athletic contests. And this is the way organized athletics began in Greece, at funerals of heroes. And the Greeks thought the Olympics arose out of things like this. And so you have one of the first accounts ever of athletic events, like a chariot race, discus, javelin throw, things like this, in Book 23 of the Iliad. The Olympics supposedly began in 776 BC. That's a legendary date, but that's the same century as Homer. So there's a long kind of interlude at the funeral of Patroclus, and then he's still sitting there with Hector's body, but the gods protected it, and it did not rot. Well, old man Priam wants his son's body back so they can give Hector a proper burial. So Priam decides to leave the citadel of Troy, come through the plain, because they're fighting in the plain around Troy, and then come down to the beach to the Achaean ships. And everybody says, you're crazy. But Hermes escorts him. He has divine protection. And Priam goes through the Greek camp and comes into the tent of Achilles. And Achilles almost kills him. He says, what? Don't talk to me. I'll run my sword through you next. Achilles is still angry. But this is what makes the Iliad great. It ends on this note. It's not just myth, by the way. It's great, as great literature as can be. And Priam says, I touched the hand that killed my son. Nobody's ever done this before. And he says, think of your own father, Achilles. He's home in Phthia, and he may never see you again. He's like me. I'll never see my son again. I'm like your father. I'm Trojan and you're Achaean, but we're alike, he's saying. So he says, have pity on me. And they realize this common humanity, which is how Achilles kind of transcends being a warrior and fighting for the Achaeans. He became an individual, questioned the whole thing about fighting, and then he goes into something greater, this common humanity with the Trojans, which is the theme of the work. Here's a quote. Achilles, peer of the gods, reflect on your own poor father, an old man just as I am, on the verge of death and extinction. Like me, he may be surrounded by those who make life a misery, with no one there to defend him against his looming destruction. So all very pessimistic. But how happy he would be to hear that you're alive. And then they cry together and they eat together. Eating together means you're friends. And Achilles says, Priam, I'll tell you about life. Zeus has two jars at his doorway, full of the lots that he gives mortals. One jar is full of blessings, the other of curses. If the thunderer mixes the two for a human, at one time his life will be painful, but equally often at other times it will be a pleasure. But you can't get an allotment of life that is unmixed shame and derision. And then you're tortured all the days of your life. And that's this famous Greek story that Zeus always gives you good and bad. As Achilles who says that, because Achilles has become this wise figure, and the work ends on this higher humanity, and they bury Hector. That's the last line of the Iliad. And you know Troy is going to fall. Well, let's just say in a couple of minutes how Troy falls. Here's a slide of Priam begging for Hector's body. And then we know that it still took a while. The Amazons actually came to fight for the Trojans. Achilles killed the queen of the Amazons. Now, there would be many more stories. How do we know about this whole story if the Iliad ends there? The Greeks had many more epic poems, which are lost to us because they weren't as good. And this is called the epic cycle, meaning it goes through the whole cycle of Troy from beginning to end. Or the cyclic epics, things like that. And we know something about these lost poems and what was in them, but the poems are lost. And sometimes the Greeks would add to it and fill out the story. So here's briefly, let's get to the fall of Troy. Paris eventually shot Achilles with an arrow in the heel. Maybe it was a poison arrow, you might have to guess, right? That was his only weakness, meaning his only mortality. But his mortality was inescapable, and his mother said, if you fight, you win glory, but die young. Then after Achilles died, there was a fight, who would get his armor? Odysseus and Ajax both wanted it. Ajax was the next best warrior before he became a household cleanser. Right? But the Greeks awarded the armor of Achilles to Odysseus. Ajax was not all that popular. He wasn't too smart. And, you know, the Greeks thought you had to be smart as well as strong. And Ajax wasn't perfect. So Ajax got all insulted and he went mad. And he went around killing the Greek leaders, but he was actually killing the sheep. And he was so mad he thought he was killing the Greek leaders. And then when he realized what he did, he fell on the sword and committed suicide. And there's a tragedy about that by Sophocles, who wrote Oedipus and Antigone. Okay, just a couple of slides. Then the Greeks are told they have to do a few things to take Troy. One is they have to get the son of Achilles from back home. And now this is obviously a later story because Achilles had been a very young man. These are the kind of things they could add to the story over time. They had to steal the Palladium from Troy, which is a statue of Athena, who also has the name Pallas Athena. They had to steal the Palladium, which is like taking Athena out of Troy. It was a magical statue that protected Troy. And it's not getting into this because Odysseus is the trickster. He went in disguise. And they have to get the bow of Heracles, which is off in this island where they landed first, where Philoctetes was stranded with him for 10 years. And they have to go to Philoctetes and say, we're really sorry. Sorry we haven't seen you in 10 years, but we can really use the bow now. Can you come help us? And there's a tragedy about that, how they persuade him to come back. And Philoctetes kills Paris. Well, Paris dies, but Helen did not let any grass grow under her feet. She took up with another Trojan husband before the war was over. And then, of course, the Greeks get this idea. How are they going to get inside Troy? Odysseus comes up with the idea of the wooden horse. They build this wooden horse that held 50 warriors, hollow, and they pretend they are leaving, and the fleet sets sail behind another island offshore, off the coast. And they actually leave a deserter behind who pretends that he's been mistreated by the Greeks and tells the whole story to make it more plausible. He tells the story of how they left and wants the Trojans to pity him to make it more believable. And they leave this large hollow wooden horse in front of the gates of Troy. And they say, this is an offering for Athena. Well, the Trojans, what do? If it's an offering for Athena, you have to give it to Athena. You can't mess with that. So they say, we have to bring this inside the walls. And this is a Greek vase, actually, from around 670 BC, close to the time of Homer. That shows the Trojan horse. It was found on Mykonos, the famous vacation island, now. Right? And there's the Trojan horse today. If you go to Troy, you can have your picture taken in the horse. Okay, but only one Trojan was suspicious of this. And this story of the Trojan horse is mostly from Virgil's poem in Latin, the Aeneid, that was written about 19 BC. So it's a lot later. That's the fullest account. And he says there was one Trojan, Laocoon, a priest of Poseidon, who thought this was a trick. He was suspicious. Beware of Greeks bearing gifts. He's the one who said that. Maybe a couple of people remember that in Latin, from Latin class. But it was fated that Troy would fall. So two serpents came from the sea to strangle Laocoon and his two sons. And this is one of the most famous ancient statues, Laocoon. And then, of course, they brought the Trojans thought this was a sign and brought the horse within the gates of Troy. That's how the Greeks got inside. This statue was a famous statue that stood in the palace of Tiberius, the second Roman emperor. And it's a style called ancient Baroque. And it was found in the Renaissance. And Michelangelo was there. He saw it being pulled from the ground and it had some influence on Michelangelo's style and became one of the most famous Greek works from the Renaissance into the 18th century. People wrote treatises about this, about art. They use this as an example. Okay, so let's just say the Greeks pour out then at night and sack Troy. Menelaus kills Helen's new man and takes Helen back. They kill baby Astyanax, Hector's a boy. They rip him from his mother's bosom and threw him from the walls. the Trojan women are taken as slaves. As there's a tragedy called the Trojan Women about this from the 5th century tragedy by Euripides. And here's the problem. The Greeks went mad slaughtering the Trojans. Ajax, this is the lesser Ajax. There was a second Ajax called the lesser Ajax. He raped Cassandra while she was holding on to an image of Athena. You were not supposed to do this. Achilles, because if you held on to a statue of a god or you went inside a temple or a sanctuary, you were protected. The word for that is asylum. That's a Greek word, meaning you cannot be violated in a sanctuary. That's where we get the word asylum. So the Trojans were clinging to the altars and the statues. But Achilles' son stabbed Priam at an altar. This is bad. There are certain rules in war, and one is you can't mess with the gods and burn the other people's temple or violate this right of asylum if they're under the gods' protection. So the Greeks committed all these impieties. And this is a drawing of that. And this is what led to the Greeks having troubles coming home. They went too far, they had hubris and offended the gods. So how Greek is that? In your triumph is your tragedy. Right? And that's why when Agamemnon came home, what happened to him? That's one reason. Who killed? There were a few reasons. One, he had sacrificed his daughter Iphigenia. Here too, the gods are offended. And then he comes home with Cassandra as his prize woman from Troy. But who's his wife again? Clytemnestra. Who kills Agamemnon? Clytemnestra kills him. And that's a great tragedy, Agamemnon by Aeschylus. Okay. There was only one Trojan who escaped, or really three. The only Trojan hero who escaped was Aeneas. With his father on his back and his young son by the hand. And the Romans later picked up on this. And Virgil wrote a poem, the Aeneid, saying that Aeneas fled Troy, because that's predicted in the Iliad, that he will survive. In the Iliad it says he will survive and be the ancestor of a new dynasty. And this meant some local dynasty near Troy. But the Romans picked up on this and said he fled Troy and sailed and traveled to Italy, and he became the ancestor of the Romans. So that's why the Aeneid is a Roman poem in Latin from the last decades B.C., that gives the Trojan War story, gives the Trojan Horse story, and connects Troy and Rome, because the Greeks had all the Greek heroes, and the Romans wanted that too, to have that ancestry from the heroic age. And Aeneas was the son of Aphrodite, and Julius Caesar said he was descended from Aeneas and Aphrodite, and therefore he was divine, he should be emperor, and the Roman emperors picked up on this for a mixture of politics and religion. Of course, we would never do that today. We would never say a president would do that, no. So that's a different story. And let's take a break there so we can talk about the Odyssey after, and I'll show you a few slides of Troy, okay? Okay. Can we do 10 minutes and go to 10 to 3?
Sure.
Okay.
Hey, are there cliff notes?
Okay, first I'll show you some slides of Troy. Since one thing we often ask about first is, was this real? Is it true? Did Hercules really live? Well, now, that's how I got into it. I get into all this and Homer, and that was my main specialty for a long time. But now I think that's not the most interesting question, because those are just facts. And, you know, the great literature of Homer goes way beyond the facts, and it's timeless. But actually, I'm still into Troy. So, I'll just show you what they found. So archaeologists were led here by this story. It shows you the power of stories. They went to try to find these rocks where it happened. You can go to Greece, by the way, something else. You can go to Greece and you can pass the meeting place of three roads, and you can look out the window and say, that's where Oedipus killed his father. You want to see where a myth happened, right? Okay, so the myths led Heinrich Schliemann here, which is a very romantic story, and biographies of Schliemann and his wife Sophie are very romantic to read. He was a self-made man, a poor German boy who was skilled at languages and taught himself many languages, including ancient Greek. And one day he was working in a shop, and he was a young boy, and he heard a drunk come in reciting poetry. And he said, "What is that? That's the most beautiful thing I've ever heard." "Oh, that's Homer, the prince of poets." And so he had to learn Greek. And then his dream, he says, his childhood dream was to find Troy. So he became a rich merchant, and here he is. and he had midlife crisis, and he went, and Schliemann did archaeology. And people knew where Troy was. They always knew the region. It's up in the northwest corner of Turkey. But they debated over different mounds, which one might be the one that fits the topography of the poems. And he just started to dig in one of these. And there was actually an American living there who had found a bunch of pottery and told him to dig at this one. And this is a man-made, a tell it's called, a man-made mound of many cities on top of each other over thousands of years that are all around this area and Mesopotamia, although they've been bombed in recent years. And he found all these walls of early fortress. He dug from 1870 to 1890 when he died, and then other people took over, and now they're back, actually. There's an American team and a German team there now finding more things. Well, nobody had seen this before, so they didn't know when it was. So that's a long story. And they found this deposit of gold. And this is his wife, Sophie. He had to marry a Greek woman. He found her by giving a test in Homer, and whoever did the best, he married her. And this is her with the gold of Troy, although this would be actually now we know more like 2000 BC or earlier, an earlier dynasty of Troy before the Trojan War. And he found these walls. The walls slant inwards. And at one point in the Iliad, it says the walls slant inwards. The Greeks are trying to climb them. And that's the entranceway you see there, where it's very defensive so they can shoot at attackers from both sides. Because when attackers come in, you have to hold your shield and your spears. So you always have one side exposed. With different towers, bastions, rear exit gates, and many cities on top of each other. And to look at the one that's from the Trojan War that the story is about, that would be from the 13th century B.C., the 1200s B.C., or even close to 1200 B.C. That's the end of the Bronze Age. And Greece was pretty much destroyed at that time around 1200. So when Mycenae and the Greek palaces were at their height, would be the later 13th century, and you look for the level of Troy that's contemporary with that, and there's some debate about it. What Schliemann found is a citadel that was only a few acres. And later, just recently, and this is still in the news, they claim they found a whole lower city, a much larger city down in the plain, but there's a big fight about this. Because they haven't found a lot, they found a few things and claim that there's a big city down there. And this would be what it would look like in that recent hypothesis of the citadel of Troy and possibly a lower city with a big question mark here. It's a question mark whether you're going to fill this in with buildings. And the Greek ships would be down here. And Troy was very strategic because if you sailed up to the Hellespont, if you want to sail into the Black Sea or northern Turkey, the Greeks were going there in the Bronze Age to get bronze. You can't have a Bronze Age without bronze, and they had to import bronze. And bronze is made from copper and tin, and these are not found in Greece. So Troy controlled the entrance to the straits here. And that is nowadays we think everything's about economics and not about stealing women. Although sometimes I think those are the same thing, right? Because people want things and that's how they have wars, right? This is what the Greeks are saying. It's your instincts, your desires that could get you into all this trouble in the first place. Whether it's for economics or greed or love or whatever. It's all, you know. So we would say, oh, it's this trade rivalry. And they put it in more human terms, that love is that kind of passion. Okay, and then there's Schliemann. Okay, so you see Troy up there, and then Schliemann went to Greece and excavated Mycenae because he needed to show there's a palace here contemporary with that. And some of Mycenae was above ground, but he discovered the palace at Mycenae with the famous Lion Gate. And this lintel block is several tons. And this was the home of Agamemnon, lord of Mycenae, rich in gold. And this is the so-called throne room up top. That's Mycenae from the air. He found the grave circle here of the early kings of Mycenae. That goes back to 1600 to 1500 BC. There are actually two grave circles known now where he found these famous gold burial masks. These are from Mycenae. And Schliemann found this and he was looking for the poems. He had the myths on his mind. So he said, I have gazed upon the face of Agamemnon. He actually said, I lifted the mask and I could see the face and then it crumbled from the air, which is kind of fantasy. But turns out this is not Agamemnon, but these are earlier. But you have to guess they're royal. So these would be the founders of Mycenae. In myth, actually, Perseus founded Mycenae. And then he found weapons and scenes of warfare. That it was obviously a warrior culture with that kind of fortification wall. And they found some objects that are like objects mentioned in the Iliad. And now we know also from the language that the Iliad contains many old words which were found in the tablets found in Greece in the Bronze Age. They found tablets with a writing system which was deciphered and shows many words go back to that time. So there are objects and words and many old things that survive in the Iliad that were passed down for centuries of oral tradition. So we know the story goes back to that time, and in fact the hero stories are all set in the Bronze Age. Almost all the Greek heroes supposedly lived in the Bronze Age and worked in this period, in the kings of palaces, and this is the only time Greeks had kings and palaces. And every place mentioned in the Iliad, you can go and find a palace in Greece, practically. Or you find pottery from the Mycenaean period showing there was a settlement in that time. So it doesn't prove the stories, but it shows this is the background to the stories. This is the dramatic date. The stories are set at that time and actually have lots of old facts that were passed down. But of course the story grows like a snowball and gets exaggerated and it becomes a story that's great literature and goes far away from the facts. Like Noah's Ark. You know, it doesn't matter if you have a piece of wood. People want the moral message of that story, right? So here again are scenes of warfare. Some of the shields are like the full-body shields mentioned in the Iliad, which didn't exist in Greece later. And just Mycenae being powerful has to be before 1200 BC for Agamemnon to be king of Mycenae, because Mycenae fell around 1200 BC. There were destructions all around the Aegean, and Bronze Age came to an end. This is down the road, another palace called Tiryns. A Hercules family came from these places. And another one, Pylos, is found in the southwestern Peloponnese. This was found by an American archaeologist where they found a trove of tablets which were later deciphered to give more evidence about the period. Okay, I'll tell you one more thing about whether it's history. So there's some facts that, you know, that match up that show us the story goes way back and was passed down over a long time and changed. Some people talk about a core, there's some kernel of the story. And we kind of want that when we talk about ancient stories, because we want Noah's Ark and Moses splitting the Red Sea. We want, you know, there's a lot invested in our cultures in these ancient stories. So that's one reason we want to grasp at their truth. Well, is there any other evidence? And here's one thing that's not well known. There was a culture to the east. Okay, if Troy is here and they have allies helping them fight, to the east of Troy, inland in Turkey, were the Hittites, a Bronze Age kingdom, where many writings were found. And they're actually mentioned in the Bible because they lasted later. Well, the Hittites have documents, and one of them is a letter to a ruler of Troy named Alexander. Alexander of Troy. Or in Hittite, that's Alexandros of Willusa. And Willusa is Willias in Greek. And Greek lost a W, and that's Ilias, Troy. As in the Iliad, the story about Troy. So, or in Latin, it's Ilium, by the way. So, you know, that's a little coincidence that there's a prince of Troy named Alexander. Who is Alexander of Troy? Paris. That's another name for Paris. The Iliad says he has two names. So that doesn't have to be the same person, but it's something to, you know, it's some kind of coincidence. And that's really the only independent evidence. But the Greeks, you know, they thought this was their early history. So many Greek myths are about the Trojan cycle, who the heroes were, what happened to them coming home, and so forth. The Greeks thought these were their ancestors. And it gave the nobles something to be proud of at the time. Homer is telling these poems in the 8th century B.C., when Greece was very aristocratic and not yet democratic at all. Okay, so they really traced their descent from these people. Okay, so let's say a homecoming story. For half an hour, some of the main features of the Odyssey, okay? Because then the Greeks had these stories of coming home from Troy. We already mentioned two. Agamemnon came home and was murdered by his wife and her new lover. And then their son had to go murder the mother eventually to get revenge. And some of the best Greek tragedies are about that story. And this type of story is called a homecoming story, a nastos. Is a Greek word. They had a series of epic poems about the homecomings of different heroes. So we're saying nastos because we get a word from that. Nostalgia. means you have pain for a home. You have, right? Longing for a home. And we mentioned another one, that Aeneas was the only Trojan hero who escaped, and the Romans later wrote a poem about him claiming he went to Italy. And that's the same type of story. But he has to find a new home, Rome. He hasn't found Rome, but he has to find a new home in Italy. So it's a twist on a homecoming story. Okay, and the greatest one is the Odyssey, the homecoming of Odysseus, also called Ulysses in Latin. Although nowadays people are going back to the Greek names much more. I'm sure you've heard that he's called Odysseus more now. This poem is about 700 BC, or some people think it's a little later. It's later than the Iliad, maybe by the same poet, maybe not, but in very much the same style as the Iliad. And it starts out, "Tell me, Muse, of the man of many ways, how much he suffered after he had sacked the holy citadel of Troy." So it characterizes Odysseus, the man of many ways, resourceful Odysseus, clever Odysseus, the survivor who lives by his wits. It also says, after he sacked the sacred citadel of Troy. Is that good news, to sack a holy place? So we were saying the Greeks committed outrages, hubris, they went too far, killing people at the altars and so on. This partly explained the troubled homecomings. So we know it took Odysseus 10 years to get home. And it's a long story, and it's a great poem, the Odyssey. And the Odyssey doesn't just go through, he left Troy and then he did this and this for 10 years. Like we were saying about the Iliad. It has a great thematic structure. It starts out on Ithaca, his home island, which is a poor, rocky island, but dear to him because that's home. That's the theme of the work. And by the way, it's a domestic theme. It's about coming home after all the fighting, coming back to your home. In the Iliad, the Trojans had homes and the Greeks didn't. That's what you want to get back. You don't want to glorify fighting for itself. And you see Ithaca in trouble when he has been away for a long time. His faithful wife Penelope is waiting home with their son Telemachus, who was just coming to manhood and hardly knew the father. He was a baby when Odysseus left for Troy. And the house is being taken over by the suitors. It's another suitor story, like the story of Helen, right? All these suitors mob the house, and 108 suitors from all the neighboring areas are eating them out of house and home and wanting to marry Penelope. They say, "Odysseus is dead, marry us." What is Penelope doing to put them off? Exactly. She is clever like Odysseus. She says, "I'll marry one of you when I finish weaving." And every night she undoes it. Okay, so it starts out with this chaos, disorder at home. And then you see Odysseus. Can he come back just in time before she marries someone else and restore order? So it ends in disorder on Ithaca. Excuse me, it begins in disorder on Ithaca, sets this dilemma, and then resolves it at the end with the restoration of order. So it's a great structure because it's in the middle that you see where Odysseus is and how he's struggling to get home with this great climax at the end. So, and then we see him and it goes through his voyages. And actually for much of the poem, he is narrating his voyages. He's telling other people what happened to him and he's the poet. So here's a little summary of his adventures from Troy. And here's a warning sign put up at the entrance to the Mediterranean. Beware, you are entering the Aegean. Beware of the Cyclops, the Sirens, etc. Okay, well, he leaves Troy and gets into various adventures. Here's a few. Actually, the second one is he has a few ships of men that he is leading back. And they come to the lands of the Lotus Eaters. Once any of them had tasted the honey-sweet fruit of the lotus, he lost his desire to return home. All they wished was to stay in the land of the Eaters of Lotus, drowsily nibbling the fruit and forgetting their hopes of return. So his men are seduced by this drug. And this is the threat. You lose your homecoming. You lose your identity. The men, his men, give way to this temptation all the time. But Odysseus has to be the strong mind. He has to be the mind ruling the body and forcing them back to the ship. Have you ever called anybody a lotus eater? Have you heard this term? This is proverbial now, especially from the 60s on. For a drug, it sounds like some drug puts you into oblivion, right? Well, from there they come to the land of the Cyclops, these one-eyed giants. The Cyclops, there are several of them, and they live in caves separately without families. So this is like the opposite of Greek society. And that's the way Homer shapes this story. In other words, it's not just the hero against the monster, but it's Greek civilization against the opposite of Greek civilization. Because that's the way the story goes. The men show up, and they go into this cave full of cheese, and they're eating the cheese. And they don't know who lives there. Well, this one-eyed giant comes back, leading his flock into the cave, and rolls a boulder to close the cave, and they're trapped inside. And his name is Polyphemus. That's the particular Cyclops they get involved with. By the way, those walls at Mycenae, the palace of Mycenae, for a little digression, the Greeks called those Cyclopean walls. They said they were so large, they must have been built by giants, the Cyclops. So they call it Cyclopean walls today, even in archaeology. That's the term for them, those large boulders. Anyway, this was a tribe of giants, and the particular one they meet is Polyphemus. And so they are his guests. And so this is kind of a story of Greek hospitality. Normally, he is supposed to be the host, and you're supposed to welcome your guests. Let me go here. And you're supposed to feed them, and then ask them who they are. Because you're supposed to feed them before it matters who they are. And there's this typical Greek ritual that's repeated throughout the poems of what happens in this hospitality scene. Well, the Cyclops inverts hospitality. So he's a threat to Greek civilization. And brings out all these morals in the story. So what happens is, a good host is supposed to feed his guest. What does the Cyclops do to his guests? He eats them. He starts eating the men. It's very grisly. I'll go back here to what happens first. Odysseus decides he has to do something. So he has some wine, and he serves the Cyclops unmixed wine. The Greeks usually diluted wine with water. So he gets the Cyclops blind drunk, so to speak, and the Cyclops says, "Who is your name? Maybe I'll eat you last." And Odysseus says, "My name is Nobody. It's the first joke in European literature." Because he's thinking ahead. And the Cyclops passes out and actually vomits up with all these man bits coming out in the vomit. And Odysseus gets this log and they heat the log in a fire and drill his eye, like a carpenter working a drill. He and his men blind the Cyclops. Here's a vase painting of that. Okay, so that would be a joke of when you tell the host your name. And then they have to get out of the cave. How do they get out? Odysseus has to be clever here. They know that the Cyclops is the only one who can move the boulder, and he has to let his sheep out in the morning. So Odysseus ties his men to the bottom of the sheep, and the Cyclops is feeling them, and he's blind. And Odysseus goes out last on the ram. And, there's this nice little miniature metal piece of that that's found in the Delphi Museum. And they get away. And the Cyclops is really angry. Odysseus has to taunt him at this point. He says, "My name is Odysseus. I come from Ithaca. And it's like a rebirth for him to leave the cave and get his identity back. And that's his whole challenge on all these voyages, is to get home and get himself back with his family and wife and son. So the Cyclops is really mad, and he says, okay, Odysseus, now I'll give you a guest gift. And that's the next thing a guest is supposed to get from the host. When they leave, the host gives you a guest gift. And the Cyclops says, this will be my guest gift. And he grabs a large rock and throws it at the ship to try to sink the ship. And it makes a wave, but the ship gets away. So the whole scene is told by Homer as a perversion of Greek society and proper hospitality. That's the kind of threat, and that's how Odysseus is coming home, will be a restoration of society and Greek values. So he has various other adventures. From there they go to the king of the winds, Aeolus. Aeolus likes Odysseus, and he says, I will give you a bag filled with all the bad winds. Just keep them tied up in this bag, and you will have safe sailing back to Ithaca. So they're sailing back. They're in sight of Ithaca. This is not long after leaving Troy, but it's too good to be true. Odysseus is asleep, and his men say, what's in that bag? It must be a treasure. Why is he so secretive? And the men give way to temptation as usual. They're not the smart minds like he is. They don't have self-control. So they ultimately all perish because of this. It's a very moral story. Actually, a different moral than the Iliad. This story says if you're good, you survive. If you're bad, you die because of your own mistake. And it's actually a lot different than everything we said before. It has a clear moral message. So the men are too foolish. They open the bag. All hell breaks loose. I mean, all Hades breaks loose. And the winds blow them away, and they don't see Ithaca again. And it takes Odysseus 10 years to get back. So they come to various other places. They come to this land of the Lacedaemonians, who are cannibals. And the description of their land is like the northern fjords. That it seems the Greeks had some knowledge of that. And he's harpooning and eating some of the men. And only Odysseus and his own ship escapes. Now he's lost his other ships, and he loses all his men little by little. They come to Circe. Circe is a goddess, a witch with magical powers. Actually, she's the aunt of Medea. Do you remember Medea was the stepmother of Theseus? And there's more to the stories of Medea. And she lives in a land with a dense mist. This is something gods have. She lives in a forest. Well, some of Odysseus' men go up to her house, and she turns them into swine. Circe is the first feminist. Men are swine. Right? And these 19th century paintings love Circe here. They make her somewhat erotic. And actually, there's a couple of good movies of the Odyssey. And Odysseus has to go up to deal with this, and he meets Hermes on the way, very convenient because he's a hero with some divine favor. By the way, Athena is usually watching out for him, as she does with heroes generally. And Hermes meets him here and gives him a little antidote, an herb from the ground. And he tells Odysseus what to do. He says, you make her swear not to change you into a pig, and then go to bed with her, and she'll be happy. So Circe and Odysseus are lovers for a year, and she changes his men back into men. And this is a little double standard. His wife Penelope is faithful, waiting for him at home, and he is very reluctantly forced to bed these goddesses on the way. And after a year, he has to leave. So, by the way, this poem was full of good women and bad women, right? Threatening women, temptresses versus the good wife at home, or bad women like Clytemnestra who killed Agamemnon. That's told throughout this story. Like, oh, I hope Penelope's not bad like Clytemnestra. I hope she's good, you know. And so then there are bad women like Circe, Calypso, the other ones, the Sirens, and the other ones that come up in this story. Well, he has to leave Circe after a year, and she tells him he has to go get a prophecy about how to get home. He has to go visit the famous prophet Tiresias, who was a prophet of Thebes. He actually comes up in 7 of the surviving Greek tragedies, famous prophet. But there's a little problem. Tiresias is dead at this point. You have to go visit Hades to get a prophecy from Tiresias. Odysseus has to go visit the shades of the dead. And this is something heroes are supposed to do, to go there and come back. It's like overcoming death, going to the limits. Gilgamesh did that first, and some parts of the story may copy Gilgamesh, which was also a voyage of discovery, like the Odyssey. Because, by the way, it starts out how much he suffered, and he saw the cities of men and learned their minds, meaning it's suffering but learning, a voyage of discovery. So there's a long scene here about how he visits the shades of the dead and what they're like and how they're miserable. He has to sacrifice a sheep to pour the blood into a pit so the shade of Tiresias can come up and drink from it, because he's just a ghost, he's a dead shade, and he doesn't have blood or understanding. So he drinks that, and then he can converse with Odysseus, and he gives him a prophecy of what to expect and how to navigate his way back home through all these perils. And by the way, my field, this is what we say we do. We give our blood to the ghosts. We give our blood to the Greeks to keep them alive, right? And because classics is not all Latin, as people think. Everybody says, I had some Latin in school, as if they were forced to do it, you know. And it's much more interesting than that. Okay, so there's a little more about the underworld scene. Then Odysseus lets some other ghost drink, and he sees the ghost of Achilles. And he can talk to Achilles after he drinks the blood. And Odysseus says, Achilles, you must be happy here. You must be Lord of all the dead. You're so great. Good to see you. And Achilles says, don't talk to me about death, Odysseus. You don't know what it's like. I'd rather be a servant working for the poorest man on earth than king over all the dead. And notice Achilles now doesn't have any consolation. This is kind of a sequel to the Iliad, where he wanted fame. Now what does he get? He's dead. And it's a negative comment on that whole heroic ideal. And Odysseus sees Ajax. He sees his mother who died of a broken heart when he never came home after so long. But he tries to embrace his mother, but she's just a ghost and flitters away. He can't embrace her. Very poignant pictures of death. And this gives, by the way, the typical Greek world of what Hades was like, the view of the underworld. Okay, so back to his voyages. Sorry?
So what did the prophet tell him?
Okay, well, he told him what's coming up next and how to go through it. So we'll say that he meets next the sirens. And so he's warned that he has to sail past the sirens. And again, these are seductive women and deadly women. Although they're not really women. So when people try to say this is a view of women, these are monsters. These are bird women. You know, this is not totally about gender. Because these are these bird women, and nobody can sail past them. The shore is littered with bones. They sing so seductively that they draw all the sailors to the shore and kill them. Well, Odysseus has had this warning, so he plugs his men's ears with wax, but he is the curious mind that wants to know and is learning from all this, and he's the mind that can endure and overcome. So he has them tie him to the mast, and he says, no matter how much I yell, do not release me. And he is able to sail past the sirens. And if you sail past them, they plunge to their death. And this is a famous vase in the British Museum. Now, what song did the sirens sing? This is a famous riddle that was posed by an English author in the Renaissance. Right? Everybody thinks, you might think, it's about sexual seduction, that men cannot resist them. There's women luring the men. But it's not. They sang heroic poetry. This is what nobody could resist. This is Homer's little scene about the power of poetry. This is what the sirens sing. For we know everything that the Argives, Greeks, and Trojans did and suffered in wide Troy. We know everything that happens. They are singing poetry, which is so beautiful and seductive and pleasing. The poems have all these scenes about the beauty of poetry and why poetry is important to life. That, by the way, you can have all these sufferings, but you can turn them into art. And that's what we can do if life is tragic. That's what the Iliad and Odyssey are about. Or why do people watch Greek tragedy? How do you get pleasure from this? Because you learn something about life. That's what Homer says. You turn tragedy into pleasure. So we'll have different passages like this about the power of poetry. So Odysseus gets through. These are other paintings of the sirens. And, by the way, you often hear, people often say, well, Odysseus got past the sirens. He has the sin of curiosity. Is this hubris for him to be the one who wants to know? No, I don't buy that at all, I have to say. Because curiosity is not a sin for the Greeks. This will be importing some biblical notion, like Adam and Eve. They knew too much, so they're made mortal. Where it doesn't praise knowledge, it says don't know too much. So for the Greeks, this is not a sin. They really didn't have the word sin. But it's not hubris, because the whole point is that he survives. He's strong enough to have his mind rule. So it's positive. And that's actually a Christian interpretation that came in the Middle Ages. Like Dante put Odysseus, Ulysses in hell for wanting to know too much, or for excessive curiosity, things, for being pagan. Well, you have to go past Scylla and Charybdis, and this is also proverbial, right? You have to go between Scylla and Charybdis, between a rock and a hard place, but much worse. Because what's bad about going past a rock, right? He has to go past Charybdis, that's a whirlpool that sucks ships down three times a day, and Scylla, who's like this dog with six heads and 12 feet that wave in the air and grab you and eat you. So the prophet Tiresias in Hades had told him how to do this, and Odysseus goes quickly by Scylla. She eats six of his men, and he's able to sail quickly past, and he gradually loses his men. They come to the island of the sun, and they are warned, just do not eat the cattle of the sun. The sun will be really angry. So the men eat the cattle while Odysseus is asleep. They always give into their belly. And they punish because of this. It has this more this good-bad morality. Because the sun god complains and punishes them, Zeus strikes the ship, and everyone drowns except Odysseus. And he floats on a mast. He's a castaway. He's sucked down into Charybdis, the whirlpool. This is really a great read. You should read the Odyssey first. It's easier to read than the Iliad, right? And there's a great translation from New Jersey by Robert Fagles at Princeton. That's a very enjoyable one to read. And Richmond Lattimore, the other Homer translations to read. Either one of those would be great. So then Odysseus comes to Calypso, who lives at the navel of the sea, the center of the sea. Calypso is a goddess. She's the daughter of Atlas. And her name means concealer. It's found in the word apocalypse, which means to reveal, to unconceal. The revelation is apocalypse, and her name, the Calypso part, means to conceal or hide. Well, he is with Calypso for 7 years. She makes him her lover, and she wants to make him immortal to be her lover forever. She'll make him a god. So who would vote for that? Go to a Greek island, live there forever with a goddess. Right? It'd be hard to find a travel agent for that. But he thinks he has a goddess back home, and he is sitting on the shore, pining away, looking out to sea. He doesn't even know where Ithaca is, looking at what direction is it, where's Penelope. All he wants is to get home to Penelope, because he's a human, he's not a god, and he needs his life back. He would not be human, he would not have his identity. So it's a great poem about human life, getting the important things for human beings. That's what you have, you know, even though you die. It's a message of humanism. So here they are, and this artist made it look like the Garden of Eden, right? And it is a kind of garden of the gods, and that's exactly what the Garden of Eden means. The Greek word for garden is paradise, paradisos. So, but notice he can't stay there. Here he is pining away on the shore. And finally, the gods take pity, and Zeus sends Hermes to tell Calypso it's time for Odysseus to go. Part of this time, Poseidon has been causing troubles for Odysseus, because Poseidon was the father of the Cyclops that Odysseus blinded. So Poseidon still makes more trouble. He sends a storm. Odysseus actually builds a ship on Calypso's island. Somehow she has all these tools. And he builds a ship. And people always call it a raft, but it's actually a ship. It gives a big description of building a ship, which is important for our knowledge of ship construction. Because now underwater archaeologists go and find these underwater ships. And I actually worked with these people myself. There's one big center for that. So he builds his ship, but it is wrecked in a storm by Poseidon. And he comes to a land of the Phaiakians, who are these magical people. And these are the people who are going to take him home. So there's a nice little story here that he's hiding in the bushes. He's shipwrecked and he almost drowns, but he finally comes up to shore and he hides and falls asleep under a bush. And the princess comes down to wash the laundry. And they're playing ball and the ball goes in and startles him and he comes out but he's naked. So he puts a leaf over him, like a fig leaf, right? And she thinks, oh, this is a nice man for me to marry. She thinks this is a suitor story, that this will be her husband. And she says, go meet my parents. And he goes to the palace, and they're a good host, so they feed him, and then they say, bring out a singer, and they bring out a singer after dinner, and they still don't know who he is. And the singer starts to sing about the Trojan War and the Achaeans, and Odysseus starts to cry. And they say, oh, we knew you were somebody. Who are you? I am Odysseus. And he was already famous to them through poetry and the fame of the story spreading already. It's been almost 20 years. So they say, we'll take you back. And they ferry him from their land. It's really a magical land. These places you can't put on the map. For a long time here, it's been off the map. There was a guessing game of, you know, where did the Cyclops live and all this. But it was off the map. This is mythical geography. Later on, they tried to identify it, and you can read about that. And they take him back. And they have these magical ships that go fast and then disappear. And this is like coming back from the dead. When you die, the ferryman takes you across the River Styx to Hades. But now they're coming back. He's coming back the opposite way, from like losing his identity, being almost dead, to coming back to life. So it's like a reverse ferryman of the dead with these magical ships. And he comes back, and he lands in it. They put him in a cave in Ithaca where he falls asleep. And they give him 13 tripods as presents, which is these large tripods with a big bronze cauldron on them. It was a prestige item. Well, archaeologists found this cave with a lot of tripods in it from the 8th century BC, funny enough. Although they think people probably offered these because of the story. They did it to copy the story. So he's in this cave, and Athena appears to him and says, you should go in disguise because you can't trust your household. You should go check it out. And he's always the clever one who's in disguise. And so, briefly, how he comes back home. Well, he goes first to visit his swineherd, Eumaeus, who he finds is loyal to him. And, by the way, the Odyssey has many more of these lower-class characters, much more about daily life, like people like this. And at this point, his son Telemachus comes. He had gone sailing to look for his father, and he comes back, and they meet up at the hut of the swineherd. And he finds out about the suitors, and they plot revenge. And Odysseus says, I'll go up to my palace in disguise. So he goes in disguise as an old beggar. And he comes to the palace on Ithaca, and the first person who spots him is his old dog, Argus, who's very old. Can a dog live for 20-plus years? I'm not sure. Maybe. And he recognizes his master, even in disguise. He jumps up, wags his tail, and drops dead. And there's something else. Why is that funny? That always makes me wonder, what's funny about that? But that's humanity. That's what the poem is about. He dies, but they have this recognition, and he knows it's Odysseus, and that's what Odysseus' life is about. That's what he wants to get back. So it's like the culmination of the whole Iliad story as well. So then these suitors are mean to him, and finally they force Penelope to marry. They find out her trick, that she's been unraveling the weaving, and they force her to set a date for the wedding. Odysseus is never coming back. So she says, okay, I'll make a contest. You are all my suitors. Let's see who can win the contest and win me. It's a suitor story, like the hero is trying to win the woman and get the palace, the kingdom. So she says, okay, we have the bow of Odysseus. Which one of you is great enough to string Odysseus's bow? And then you have to shoot it through 12 axe heads. Whatever that means, nobody's really sure what that means. They line up 12 axes in the ground, and you have to string the bow and shoot an arrow through 12 axes. Maybe just through the curvature, or maybe there was a loop atop of them. It's kind of all guesswork what that means. It was something much older that Homer put into the poem and maybe got it from somewhere else and it got lost in translation a little bit. None of them can do this. And then the beggar, Odysseus, comes along and he does it and then he reveals himself as Odysseus. So he's like a suitor who wins his own wife back. He wins the suitor contest and he strings the bow and shoots it through the 12 axes, whatever, however you do that. And then he shoots the suitors down with his son Telemachus. And his son comes back to life and he grows up with becoming a hero like his father and fighting with his father. And they had planned all this. They'd hidden the weapons and closed the doors so the suitors are trapped. And they killed them off. And they hung the maids who were the lovers of the suitors that he thought were disloyal to him. And he found out who was loyal to him. And one was the old servant woman, Eurycleia, who had been his maid since he was a boy that his father had purchased for 20 oxen. The old maid woman in the house was loyal to him. And actually, when Odysseus was a beggar, she recognized him by a scar on his leg. And there's a nice story about that at one point. How he got the scar from a boar hunt, and that's how he got his name. That's a little digression. Anyway, she's loyal. She had recognized him. And so he restores order. And still, though, he has to have a reunion with Penelope. So this is a little nice ending to the story. Penelope is still suspicious. She's like a female Odysseus. She's clever. Is this really you? And she has to test him. So she says, okay, if you're Odysseus, go get the bed from our bedroom and bring it out. And Odysseus says, no, nobody can do that, because I built that bed on the stump of a large olive tree. It's rooted in the ground. The room was built around it. And she says, oh, now I know it's you, because nobody else knew that. And so they go to bed, and they make love heroically all night. But they do more than that. They stay up all night telling stories, because this is a story about telling stories. Odysseus is in disguise, and he's always telling these stories. And all these stories of his wandering, he actually told those stories, actually to the Phaeacians who entertained him and took him in at the end and then brought him home. They said, what happened to you? And that's when he tells most of these wanderings at that point as a long digression where he's the poet to them. And then he comes home and order is restored. And the last thing he does is he goes and visits his father. And his father and his son are like rejuvenated by his presence. And by the way, when Penelope was weaving something and unraveling it, do you know what that was? That would have been a shroud for Laertes, the father. So then she undoes it, and when Odysseus comes back, it's like the father is rejuvenated. He doesn't have to have the shroud. So they're all back together. And there are other stories about how he lives a long life, and there's a funny story about how he dies that we don't need to say now. But let's just end with this. So that's his Knossos, his happy homecoming, unlike Agamemnon. And there's a famous poem, Ithaca, by Constantine Cavafy. Do you know this poem at all? This is the most famous modern Greek poem probably now. Cavafy is the greatest modern Greek poet. He was earlier 20th century, and he lived in Alexandria, which was still Greek, and not anymore. And he was discovered by E.M. Forster, actually. And he's getting bigger and bigger all the time. You can find his poems on the web. And he wrote a poem, Ithaca. This was actually read at Jackie Onassis' funeral out here near Burnsville. It was her favorite poem. And we know where she got that from. Right? From her own Greek island. Okay. So, it goes like this. Ithaca. When you set out on your journey to Ithaca, pray that the road is long, full of adventure, full of knowledge. The Lastragonians and the Cyclops, angry Poseidon, do not fear them. You will never find such as these on your path if your thoughts remain lofty. If a fine emotion touches your spirit and your body, the Lastragonians and the Cyclops and fierce Poseidon, you will never encounter if you do not carry them within your soul, if your soul does not set them up before you. Pray that the road is long, that the summer mornings are many, when, with what pleasure, with what joy, you enter ports seen for the first time. Stop at Phoenician markets and purchase fine merchandise, mother of pearl and coral, amber and ebony, and sensual perfumes of all kinds. As many sensual perfumes as you can. Visit many Egyptian cities to learn and to learn from scholars. Always keep Ithaca in your mind. To arrive there is your ultimate goal, but do not hurry the voyage at all. It is better to let it last for many years and to anchor at the island when you are old, rich with all you have gained on the way, not expecting that Ithaca will offer you riches. Ithaca has given you the beautiful voyage. Without her, you would never have set out on the road. She has nothing more to give you. And if you find her poor, Ithaca has not deceived you. Wise as you have become, with so much experience, you have understood what these Ithacas mean. Right? So that's a poem. This is the journey, not the destination. You understand what these Ithacas mean. What is that? That's about homecoming, what makes life valuable. And I think Ithaca is ultimately death. Don't hurry the voyage to Ithaca, right? Okay. So that's how the Greek myths are about understanding life and death and all the biggest issues on a biblical proportion, actually. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. Okay, you guys were great to sit through it all. Any questions? And what are you going to do? Read the Odyssey, right? And then you can read the Iliad, and then you can go to Greek tragedy, and then you can learn Greek. Okay?